Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And Southside Broadcasting. .podbean.com.
Killing cancer kindly are three words that you may not have ever thought of actually appearing in the same sentence, but it is something which perhaps from a revolutionary perspective might well actually have a lot of possible traction in terms of genuine ways in which we can actually cope with this challenging situation, which for so many years has been seen either as a death sentence or something which is inevitably, irrevocably going to change a particular lifestyle approaches and so on and so forth. So how are we actually going to go into this particular system? And also, how should we possibly consider a do absolutely nothing approach to this whole thing? Well, we have a superb individual to actually join us now to effectively share his own wisdom in this particular area. Somebody who has effectively got a range of experience, a wealth of experience, is lead consultant clinical oncologist at Queen's Centre for Oncology and Hematology at Castle Hill Hospital. It's the wonderful Dr. Mohammed Khan. How are you, Mohammed?
I'm fine. Thank you very much, Alex. Thank you for having me. I just give a little bit of correction. I'm the lead oncologist in Scarborough General Hospital, but I also work at Queen's Oncology Hematology Center, but I'm not the lead there.
Fantastic. Okay, well, we've got that sorted out. The fact of the matter is you do have the medical credentials and the expertise to actually talk about this. This is not just what could be described as, oh, yes, 30 seconds of sunlight a day. Yeah. Tell me something else about the whole thing. If that's the case, why, for instance, just up the road from Scarborough with the James Cook University Hospital, where you have so much effort being expended in oncology and so on and so forth. We'll progress from that. Let's just deal with that headline, because it is one which certainly caught our attention. And I think is really fascinating. 30 seconds of sunlight each morning could effectively reduce the risk of cancer by up to 80%. Can you just share with us how you came up with that particular figure? And again, just develop the narrative, please.
Yes. A lot of research has been going on cancer treatment and understanding the disease. One of the areas where we are lacking is prevention. And the risk of cancer has been getting higher. In the 1990s, it was 25% in UK. In 2000, it became 33%, as one in three. Shocking. In 2017, it went up to 50%. So one in two people have a lifetime risk of getting cancer in England. United Kingdom, to be honest, all over England. So this is something which is really startling. Not a lot of work is going into it because prevention doesn't generate a lot of money. So pharmaceuticals are not interested. And that's where me and my friends and colleagues and team come in with Killing Cancer Kindly. And we are looking at cancer and we are trying to understand it better. And one of those things was this magical chemical called melatonin, which is produced in every cell of the body. It is produced in the small parts of the cell, organelles, they call them, named mitochondria. And what it does is it detoxifies any toxic chemicals that might be produced in the body within the cell. So it is one of the most potent detoxifying chemicals in the body. Now, melatonin initially was thought was made in the brain, in the pineal gland, and usually in the night. And people thought that darkness triggers the release of melatonin. But in 2016, research was being done in America, especially in the University of Texas, and scientists saw that melatonin is mostly, more than 95%, produced in the daytime and produced in each and every cell in the mitochondria. And the time when it is produced most effectively, when a flood of melatonin comes out, that is early morning, between sunrise and 9 a.m. This is the time period when the human body clock sets in. So you're setting your body clock for the day, the circadian rhythm, as we call it, and it gets triggered. The ignition switch is turned on early morning. But for that, you need at least 30 seconds of sunlight exposure to the eyes on a bright and sunny day.
And one of the things which immediately sprung to my mind when I was reading through some of the background to this is something we've spoke about many times, actually, as far as Siren Radio and indeed Southside Broadcasting are concerned, and the need to actually deal with nutrition, deal with education, and as you rightly said earlier, deal with prevention rather than the often invasive, often very aggressive approaches that have been taken, certainly with respect to chemotherapy in times past. And that's something which, in many cases, arguably, conceivably, did more harm to the patient than good, insofar as, yes, it might have cured and killed a number of cancer cells, but it might have cured or killed a number of patients as well. I mean, we don't want to go into that too much, but I love the line that you've actually said, killing cancer kindly, because this is something where that natural way in which cells will reproduce and through mitosis, meiosis, etc., work through that whole process. This is something which perhaps we can actually manage, and indeed, to echo your own passion in life, actually look to not only prevent, but also cure the cancer challenge.
You're very right, Alex. And this is exactly the reason why we came up with this name of killing cancer kindly. I'll tell you something interesting, but it's also quite scary. So hold on to your seat. Make sure you don't fall off. Every day in every human body, yours and mine, 800 to 1,000 cancer cells are made. That's normal. Every human body has up to 1,000 cancer cells made every day. This can go up to 2,500 cells a day on certain days, depending on the risk factors we are exposed to. Human body has the ability to kill each and every one of them. And it does it so kindly that you and me never even realize that 1,000 cancer cells were born today and 1,000 cancer cells got killed today. And these are the mechanisms of the human body which we are looking into, Killing Cancer Kindly team, and including melatonin, this rush of melatonin in the morning, detoxifying every cell, telling the body, wakey, wakey, it's daytime. You need to detoxify every cell and get on with the day, start the circadian rhythm with a big ultimate detox with just 30 seconds of sunlight. But nobody talks about it, Alex, because if you could bottle sunlight and sell it on the shops, everyone would be advertising about it. But because it's for free, there's no commercial incentive. We live in a very material world. Everything is cost effective, this and cost effective, that, and generating money and what is in it for me. And that's how the world is going, which is quite sad. But we, as a team, and many people are joining us, and we're getting this, I call it a global mission, and more people are joining in. And I've also written a handbook, which is a first proper handbook on preventing cancer and understanding cancer, which is going to come out in the next few months. And Killing Cancer Kindly is creating the awareness, giving the knowledge, the weapon of knowledge to fight in this war against cancer. And coming back to this daytime light thing, you would be surprised to know that an average UK person spends 22 hours of their day indoors. Now, in America, this is, if you go in percentages, this is like 93% of the time. So that's the modern day lifestyle we talk about. We always hear the term modern day lifestyle, but this is a very important part of the modern day lifestyle, that being daytime creatures, the technical scientific term is diurnal, we live a nighttime creature life, nocturnal. We are awake late in the night. We have artificial lights. Daytime, we hardly venture out, even if we are awake. And in America, for example, 87% of the time, people are in the buildings, like your office, radio station, hospitals, restaurants, shops. Same in UK. 6% of the time, American people are behind the wheel of their car. And the light which comes through the windscreen or through the windows is much less intense. And it lacks that particular part of the light spectrum, the near infrared, which is needed to trigger the melatonin release in the morning. And I'll give you some figures about it. Like we measure distance in centimeters and weight in kilograms. Similarly, light is measured in lux. So lux is a unit of intensity of light. I mean, one lux is equal to the light produced by one candle. So if you are sitting behind your window or behind a windscreen of your car, the amount of light you get is usually about 50 lux, 50. Whereas if you're standing outside or you roll down the window of your car or open the window of your house and stick your head out, you will get from anywhere between 10,000 lux to 130,000 lux. So there's a massive amount of difference, which our eyes don't perceive, our body don't perceive. But there's a huge amount of difference of light exposure behind glass and outside. And that is the amount you need to trigger the release of beneficial chemicals in the body, especially melatonin in the morning. So on the most downcast day, it is a very downcast day up here in East Yorkshire. I don't know how things are in Lincoln. Are you having
a... I think it's fair to say downcast is a good adjective to use to describe the meteorological conditions, yes.
So on a very downcast day, all you need is half an hour. You don't have to look into the sun. I hope nobody does and nobody will. You just have to stand outside, look pretty, which is easy for you to do, Alex. And you can even get the light reflected from the plants. Now, it's a great benefit of nature. The plants who feed on light, they have chlorophyll and they absorb light. They do not take in the near infrared light. They just reflect it back. So even if you're walking in a park, standing under a tree, looking at plants, you don't know it, but your body is getting a huge amount of near infrared light. It hits the back of your eye, the retina, the lower part. So you have to look a little bit up. Don't look down like on a mobile screen. Look up. It hits the lower part of the retina, and there are newly discovered light-sensitive cells known as retinal ganglion cells, photosensitive retinal ganglion cells, who pick up that light. Within 30 seconds on a bright day or 30 minutes on a gloomy day, they trigger the brain and tell them it's daytime. Let's start the circadian clock. And the brain tells every cell of the body, release your melatonin. So the mitochondria are opening the floodgates of melatonin. Melatonin comes out, looks for any toxins, oxidative products, which can cause damage to cell, damage to DNA, can cause cancer, can cause aging, can cause atherosclerosis, all other kind of diseases and damaging problems in the body. And melatonin neutralizes them. So you start the day with a wonderful detox and by reducing the risk of cancer. Now, this is the quality of melatonin, which has been studied a lot. The quantitative effect, how much the reduction is a little bit difficult to calculate. There's a lot of indirect evidence. Like, for example, UK, the risk of cancer, lifetime risk of cancer is 50%. The United States, 48%, pretty close. Australia, 48%-ish. Norway, Sweden, Scandinavian countries in the 30%, Canada around 30%. But in the Middle East and in the Far East, you're getting this risk much lower. In the Middle East, in India, it's around between 9 to 11%. So there's a huge difference. And culturally and traditionally, in most societies, people ventured outside. There were many reasons for that. Some had religious rituals to go out. In Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, even Christianity, the monks, they went out. So there was an excuse and a reason for people to go out in the morning. And traditionally, if you remember, there used to be something called a school assembly. Kids used to be standing outside in the schoolyard before going into the classes. Now, that was also a cultural and traditional thing, which we didn't know was helping produce melatonin, but it was definitely helping detox the body cells and reduce the risk of cancer. We have now, with our team Killing Cancer Kindly, and we've got a website and we've got a YouTube channel with a lot of information, more information in it, or and on many other ways on how to easily reduce the risk of cancer. Our team is now devising a research trial in which we are going to quantify the exact amount of benefit which people can get from that early morning release of melatonin in reducing the risk of cancer. But if you compare it globally, and in the Western civilizations, United States, UK, Australia, all different weather conditions, the risk is somewhere between 48 to 50%. Whereas in traditional areas like the Middle East, the risk is around 9 to 11%. So you can see there is almost an 80% difference. How much of that is accounted by melatonin? That has to be established. The jury is still out on it. There's a lot of research ongoing in this matter. And our team is especially devising a very clever study, a retrospective study, which is going to answer this question hopefully in the next 1 year.
It's particularly interesting. You mentioned, of course, those little sausage-shaped engines, the mitochondria, which are very much the energy blocks of our cells and structures. I mean, I recall obviously my own degree level biology in which we were sort of analyzing that, and also the impact that coenzyme Q10, selenium, other nutritional supplements can actually have on that. But certainly from your own research in terms of Killing Cancer Kindly, and I'm certainly very keen to actually see the forthcoming book that you're producing, the first anti-cancer guidebook. It does seem as though this holistic approach, which has almost been hidden in plain sight, arguably for centuries, but because of a variety of reasons, not least of which may possibly be the importance of pharmaceutical industries and their profit margins, and again, the need to actually quantify things, and maybe this educational side of things, the genuine education, needs to actually reach a wider audience, because certainly it is very much in keeping with this notion that, again, the cures are actually there. We don't have to necessarily whip off the limbs. And just as in many ways, you know, gangrenous limbs used to be taken off as a matter of course, you know, things have changed, things have moved on. And perhaps through your own good work, we are actually at least beginning to appreciate the line that, yes, the melatonin, the circadian rhythms, all these things in balance. Maybe there is a line, as you say, it could well be the ultimate detox.
Absolutely. And as you said, the cure is within our body. I mean, if your body is killing 1,000 cancer cells a day, it's definitely has the strategy and the plans and the means to kill cancer and kill it kindly. And you mentioned selenium and pharmaceuticals, two words which just clicked in my mind. An interesting thing, just on the sidelines, which is also my area of interest, selenium is known to reduce the risk of cancer, especially prostate cancer, along with vitamin E. By the way, melatonin is twice as potent as an antioxidant and vitamin E. So there was a trial done called the SELECT trial, in which they gave synthetic selenium and vitamin E to patients. And what they found was that the risk of cancer went higher rather than lower. And I've looked at the trials in the last 30 years, and there's a YouTube video on Killing Cancer Kindly, our YouTube channel, which gives all those trials and details and everything. Every time you use the vitamins and minerals synthetically, either they don't give any benefit or they increase the risk of cancer. Whereas the same vitamins and minerals, when taken naturally in form of fruits and vegetables, reduce the risk of cancer. And it is very simple that your natural food products, they have a slow release mechanism of vitamins and nutrients, which they release in the body, and the body only takes what it requires. When you give synthetic forms, they push and force their way into the system, and they benefit the cells which are dividing most rapidly. And with 1,000 cancer cells born every day, you are feeding them, and you're making it difficult for the body to kill cancer. So synthetic vitamins and nutrients, and most of them are not used there for your and my benefit. They are used to generate more profit for the companies and to preserve the food. Like vitamin C is one of the commonest additives to food, to preserve the food and extend the shelf life. And this is a major area of concern. One of the big reasons why cancer rates are rising and now have crossed 50%. The reason is that we are using so many toxic chemicals just to maximize the profit. So the sandwich, which is made by a certain company, is going to stay on the shelf for 2 weeks, and there are more chances of someone picking it up rather than rotting away within a day, which is normally when you and me make a sandwich in our kitchen, it won't last till the evening. But on the shelf of your local shop, it's going to stay there for weeks and weeks because it's got about 28 or 30 different preservatives added. So I often see this, Alex, that when I look at cancer cells are greedy cells. They are cells which do not care about the rest of the body. They do not want to contribute to the body. All they want is to eat and grow, and their greed has no limit. And then I look at society, and I see these elements in our society who are profit-driven, and they want more and more and more, and there's no limit to how much they want. And they don't care what effect they have on the society. And then I look at the planet, and human beings as a race are doing to the planet, what cancer does to the body. We are taking, not caring about the rest of the planet, about the rest of the creatures. And all we want is more and more for ourselves. So there's a lot to learn in killing cancer kindly.
It's a fascinating take on both the macroverse and the microverse, perhaps. How can people find out more? How can people access the YouTube channel? Is there a website that people can actually go to, Dr. Khan, to find out more details about your work and so on?
Yes, there is a website, and we are on Instagram and Twitter and TikTok, and we are also on Facebook and YouTube. But YouTube is the major source because TikTok and Instagram don't let us put long videos. Mm-hmm. And we put short and long, all kind of videos. The most comprehensive information you'll find is on the YouTube channel. So just Google Killing Cancer Kindly and it comes up. Even if you don't put with Dr. Khan, it usually comes up to the channel because it's not a very common name. And you have detailed information on how multivitamins affect risk of cancer, how light reduces risk of cancer, how vitamin D and other vitamins work, and many other factors. We are trying to make it as global as possible. We've got 6 different languages for some of the videos. We couldn't do it for all, but we're working on it. And as I said, it's of a global mission. We do not differentiate between any geographical areas. So my dream is, and this is a dream I share with everyone, including the person I started this mission with 22 years ago, that we have to reduce the risk of cancer from 50% down to less than 5%. And ideally, I think it can be kept at about 1%. There are some native populations which have the risk of cancer around 1%. And when you take people out of their native population from their traditional background and put them in a modern day lifestyle, the risk goes high and they adopt the same risk of the environment and the society they're living in, which shows that most of the cancer is due to lifetime and environmental factors.
It certainly has been a fascinating and insightful piece today, and I would be remiss, Dr. Khan, if we didn't say, will you be kind enough to join us again in the not-too-distant future and share more of your findings and maybe discuss some of the other aspects? I mean, we've talked about briefly selenium, we talked about coenzyme Q10, we maybe talk about pycnogenol. There are other areas that are actually out there, but certainly obviously focusing on your own work and how, so to go back to that original line, simply using the benefits of sunlight to actually activate the melatonin, providing the ultimate detox in so many ways can be a wonderful way in which we can have a better quality of life, shall we say. So will you be kind enough to return?
Absolutely, I would love to. And Alex, I'd like you to join us in this mission. This is everyone's mission. And together we can and we will save more lives. And it's just not acceptable. And I often say that there's no creature, no species of animals on this planet with a 50% risk of any disease, let apart cancer. Yet in the modern world, especially in the United Kingdom, our home, we have a 50% lifetime risk of cancer, which was 33% before and 25% before that, and is rising. So where are we heading? Are we going to be a society with 80, 90% of risk? And are we going to be a society which is only focused on how to treat cancer, whereas the incidences are rising and nobody's bothered why cancer is happening more common, why we are the only species of animals with a 50% lifetime risk? And the answer to these questions are very simple and very important. And we need to reach out to people and inform them about it. And there are so many simple measures which can reduce the risk of cancer. Among these things, one last thing I'd like to tell you about, I mean, I can go on and on. I can read the whole of my book to you, but I won't do that. Opening the window in your house for an hour would let out a toxic gas known as radon, which comes from the core of the planet and is found all over the world and increases the risk of lung cancer. Now, we know cigarette smoking causes lung cancer, but nobody talks about radon gas, which is an important risk factor for lung cancer. So just opening a window in the house for 1 hour would let out that gas once a day, and you reduce the risk of lung cancer.
Again, fascinating and something we definitely need to talk more of. For the moment, though, Dr. Mohammed Khan, consultant clinical oncologist and lead for oncology services and principal investigator for a number of cancer research trials at Scarborough General Hospital. Huge thanks. And let's hope that we can continue to work together to share the education, to lead out the potential that we all have, but some of us kind of have forgotten about it, perhaps due to the busyness of our lives.
Thank you very much for having me, Alex, and I look forward to collaborating more on this mission with you. And I'd love to have you on board. It would be a great asset for our team to spread the word and to spread the awareness.
Well, it's often said that you need to actually have a holiday after you've had a holiday, if that makes some kind of sense, to recover from the holiday at least. But it does seem as though as we approach UK Disability History Month, if you happen to have a disability or are differently enabled, it could be even more stressful. 51% of respondents to a recent survey with a disability saying going on holiday was associated with stress, and another 36% relating it to frustration. So to actually address this, we're delighted to welcome the co-chief executive officer and co-founder of Ocean Holidays. That's the fabulous Harry Hastings. How are you, Harry?
I'm good, thank you, Alex. How are you?
I'm okay. Now, this is something which obviously impacts your good self personally, because you've got a two-year-old son, Rudy, who has got a rare genetic condition called MCAHS. One, would you like to just tell us a little bit about MCAHS1, please?
Of course. Thanks, Alex. So MCAS1, it's a bit of a mouthful when you have to go through it. He was diagnosed in his first year of born in 2020 and suffers from epilepsy, mobility issues due to floppy muscles, as well as intellectual disability. So he'll likely be non-speaking. And, you know, as a result of that, we as a family have had very many challenges when traveling, as you mentioned earlier.
Now, allowing for that, Harry, I mean, clearly we talk about holidays being some way in which we can get rid of the stress and so on. And for families and for people who actually happen to suffer a disability, that can't be good. So presumably, you know, looking at the survey findings, were you shocked? Were you surprised? Did you think, yeah, something needs to be done?
I wasn't surprised in the slightest, to be honest with you. Our company, Ocean Holidays, we specialise in holidays to Florida. So for many, many years, 20 years next year, in fact, we have been organising trips for people to go to, you know, the Sunshine State, the rest of the USA, and indeed worldwide. And so when you're booking multi-generational families and bigger groups that travel together, we have often had challenges and found it difficult to be able to ensure that we service all of the needs of the people that are traveling. And, you know, when I look at my own personal experiences, Rudy was born, as I said, in 2020, and I've been very fortunate to travel a little bit since 2020. And I personally and my family have felt those challenges as we have been on trips. You know, more recently, we went to Mallorca, for example, and, you know, this is just to give you one example of some of the many challenges that families like us face. Is, you know, we have for Rudy, he needs postural support because he can't hold himself up. We already own two specialist chairs that we bought at home out of our own pocket. And recently we had to fly to Mallorca with a scheduled airline that we've not flown on before, and they didn't accept one of our two chairs. So we had to go and get another chair, and that chair to purchase would have cost more than £3,000. So we rented it for a few weeks, and to rent that chair was the equivalent cost of car hire. And, you know, that is just one of many, many examples and challenges that people like Rudy and families like us have. And disabled people across the country will have lots and lots of different stories. I'm sure there could be books and books and books written about them. And, you know, the combination of the holidays that we sell and the personal experiences that I've had, as well as the realization that, you know, one in five British people are registered disabled, and as a result of that, you know, one in five British people that are going on holiday are likely disabled as well. So it's a really important topic for us, and it's one that's close to my heart.
Indeed, and of course, there's always the line that not every disability is visible, so there are other issues as well in terms of that side of things. Ocean Holidays, as we mentioned, has recently launched an accessibility program. Can you just share a few ideas in terms of what things you put into place to ensure that people who sign up with Ocean Holidays maybe have a little bit less stress than they would normally have to encounter?
Yeah, of course. So a big part of our push is that for the last over a year now, we've invested over £100,000 across the business. We employ 200 people at Ocean Holidays, and we're very, very much a people business. So you can't book online with any of our two travel businesses, Ocean Florida and Winged Boots. And we have invested a lot of time and money in training champions across our business, many of which within Ocean Holidays have disabled family members or have experiences with friends and going on holiday with people that are disabled, which has been really interesting. So we've trained up lots of people within our business who are our dedicated specialist champions. That's the first thing that we've done. In addition to that, on our website, so ocean-florida.co.uk/accessible-holidays, we've created a really comprehensive accessibility information hub, and that hub covers everything from information on how best to work out how to fly, what hotels that we provide which are accessible and friendly for both hidden and visible disabilities. We've got a partnership with the Hidden Disability Sunflower Program, where we specialize in Florida. We've got lots of information on theme parks as well. And it's a holistic approach to anyone who has a disability and wants to go on holiday. At the moment, it's focused on Florida and the rest of the USA. And yeah, they're the two things really that we're doing is we're providing information for people and training to our staff. And then last but not least, of course, we've contracted and been working with all of our suppliers in the background to make sure that when you do book a holiday, so we have a list of accessible friendly villas, for example, and autism certified hotels. So the lists go on and on and on. What I always find really interesting, because I don't think I'm a total specialist, is the frequently asked questions on the accessibility hub. It's really interesting because there's lots of different bits of information that answer so many questions for disabled travellers.
And if people wish to find out more about Ocean Holidays and the excellent work that you're actually doing, where would you point them?
Go on to the Ocean Florida website. We're launching our accessibility program today, so there should be a big banner on the homepage over the course of the next few days and weeks. Or if you want to go directly to the page, it's ocean-florida.co.uk/accessible-holidays.
Well, well done on actually doing more than just a drop in the ocean, pun intended. We're actually sorting things through. But Harry Hastings, Co-Chief Executive Officer and Co-Founder of Ocean Holidays, many thanks indeed. And inevitably, happy holidays, Harry.
Thank you, Alex. You too.
Well, the cost of living crisis continues to bite, and as November begins to get slightly colder and we head into December, it may well be that you consider going for a portable electric heater. But beware, there are challenges with respect to this. And to actually talk us through some of the safety tips you need to be aware of if you are intending to use a portable electric heater, we're delighted to welcome product safety engineer from Electrical Safety First, Sir Giuseppe Capanna. Giuseppe, just talk to us again a little bit more about the importance of ensuring that if you are going for an electrical heater this winter, that you make sure you go through a number of key safety checks.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's, you know, just a few safety tips that could save your life. You know, they're very simple tips. Like, for example, don't run your heater close to sort of fabrics like curtains or close to your bed linen. Don't use a heater with an extension lead, because heaters draw a lot of power and extension leads can get overloaded very easily. It's also important not to, you know, you run them overnight or unattended for long periods of times. You know, we've seen, you know, devastating mistakes that have been made.
And these are all critical aspects. I must admit, the extension lead is something which I suspect many people didn't think about, because, you know, clearly extension leads there. You obviously sort of take your heater to where you want it to. So that needs to be very much borne in mind.
That's right. You also have to think about where you position your heater. Like if you've got sort of trailing leads and you've got the thing in the middle of the room, you know, it's also a trip hazard, especially if you've got kids and pets running around.
I mean, regularly inspecting the heater for damage and deterioration, again, particularly important if you've actually used it over several years and you think, oh, we'll just get it out of the cupboard now.
Well, yeah, if you're getting an old, it's better to buy, you know, have a new heater that you've bought from a reputable retailer that you trust. That's the best way to make sure it's safe. If you do need to use an older heater that you've maybe got out of the loft or somewhere else, make sure you inspect it for damage. And if you see any damage, don't use it. It's not worth risking your property or your life.
And obviously avoiding secondhand heaters or indeed pre-loved heaters, not to be encouraged at all.
Well, of course, because you just don't know the history of these heaters.
I noticed you also suggest that you should register the appliance and ensure that you check that the heater hasn't been recalled, because clearly there are dangerous products out there still in the marketplace.
Oh, absolutely. You know, especially if you're buying from, you know, a third party seller on an online marketplace. You know, it's quite important that you register your product, and that way you can be sure that if there is a problem from the manufacturer, they know how to get in contact with you in order to, you know, get the problem, the product taken back or repaired.
The other thing that Electrical Safety First have actually been responsible for, Giuseppe, is actually producing a video which might help people. Can you just point us in the direction of where they can locate it?
Yes, if they go to www.electricalsafetyfirst.org.uk, there's the video on there. There's also lots of other safety tips for electric heater use that you can find on our website.
And would you say it's an economic aspect that is forcing people to actually say we won't have the central heating, we'll just go for the electric heating? Is that pretty much it? And does it actually make any sense in the long run, actually, in terms of switching to electrical heaters as opposed to, or portable ones as opposed to central?
Well, if you were going to use electric heaters to heat the whole of your house, then no, it doesn't make any economic sense. But that's not what our researchers found. Our researchers found that people are considering sort of not using their central heating systems to heat the whole house and, you know, heating a smaller space, such as like, you know, one room in their house, and they're using electric heaters to do this. And we're just sort of like looking at this changed behavior and just trying to make people safe.
Yeah, absolutely. And just a reminder, Giuseppe, where can people find Electrical Safety First online?
Yeah, they can find it at www.electricalsafetyfirst.org.uk.
Giuseppe Capanna, Product Safety Engineer for Electrical and Safety First. Many thanks indeed, and stay warm.
Yeah, thank you, Alex.
We've heard over the years, obviously, about the deficiencies that can occur with respect to estrogen challenges in terms of, obviously, women's health. But what about testosterone? It's often regarded as being a bit problematic, and obviously it's used in a negative sense in lots of ways. People talk about testosterone-fueled activities and so on. But what about a testosterone deficiency, and how can this actually impact on the well-being of men across the globe in many ways? Well, to talk us through some of the findings in terms of this, we're delighted to welcome Senior Medical Advisor for TEDS Health and Urology and Sexual Medical Consultant at the wonderful sort of area that is Professor Geoffrey Hackett. How are you, Geoffrey?
I'm very well indeed, Alex. Thank you very much.
Excellent. So share with us the findings about this, because I think it's fair to say that we don't really talk too often about men's sexual health, certainly when it comes to testosterone. So explain what exactly testosterone deficiency is.
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, because men aren't very good about speaking about personal problems, particularly to their GP. And women have really been well aware that the menopause is an inevitable event for them. But men do suffer problems as well, and men lose their levels of testosterone, the male hormone, from about the age of 30 by about 1% to 2% per year. But there are a group of men who, because of medical conditions, lose testosterone much more quickly than that. And they run into considerable health problems. And in fact, they die earlier and they have more cardiac disease. And these men we're looking at are men with type 2 diabetes, men who are obese, men who have kidney disease, high blood pressure, or who take a whole range of medications like antidepressants and tranquilizers.
So a whole range of issues coming together with respect to that. So, I mean, talk us through how many symptoms men should actually experience before they should actually go and say, that's it, it's time I actually spoke to a professional about this. I need to actually address this issue now.
Yeah, well, that's probably the most important question of all, because a lot of research has been done, and the three key symptoms that are likely to predict that a man has a low level of testosterone are erectile dysfunction, which there's been quite a bit of publicity about in recent years, but more importantly, loss of morning erections. And I would urge men to be on the lookout for this one, because they generally put this down to a whole load of other things. The fact they're just getting older, they might be drinking too much, these sorts of things. So loss of morning erections, vitally important. And the third one is loss of libido, or loss of desire to have sex. And this is also a very subtle thing that they might put down to a whole host of other random medical conditions. And the important thing about these is when you get these symptoms, we know that men are at risk of having significant cardiac event within 3 to 5 years if they ignore them. Then there's all the other symptoms, such as just loss of physical strength, increased tiredness, poor sleep, sweating, brain fog, where you actually forget where you put things and you get confused in situations where you should be under control. These things are much more subtle and can often be linked with other conditions, and indeed missed by general practitioners if you complain about them. They often get put down to depression. And if I had a pound for every patient that I see who'd been started on an antidepressant by their doctor, in the hope that this would sort them out, only to find that it's made things worse, I'd be quite a rich man.
Mm. So again, if people are seeking treatment from this point of view, how accessible is it? Or is it a case of, well, you can join a waiting list and maybe by the time we get to the year 2045, we might consider you?
Absolutely. And I became so frustrated over the 30 years that I've been passionate about men's health that we seem to be getting nowhere. And I spoke to colleagues, professors around the country who were saying, oh, we're slowly getting there, the boat is turning. But we were really not making any progress compared with what was happening in women's health. So this is why I became involved and thought we had to change things. And so I became a senior medical advisor for TEDS Health and thought that it was time that men were able to take control, because their GPs have got an awful lot on. We know what the situation is in the health service, and you can't expect your busy GP to be motivated to look after every aspect of your health. So TEDS Health is a digital healthcare platform where men can go online, search their medical symptoms, get access to an expert, and to get tested, get blood tests done, to get health advice about exercise, lifestyle, diet, everything that goes along with making them healthier and happier.
And presumably the best place to go to find out further details would be tedshealth.com.
Absolutely.
Professor Geoffrey Hackett, Senior Medical Advisor at TEDS Health, and of course, consultant in urology and sexual medicine. Huge thanks. And inevitably, it goes without saying, Professor Hackett, stay healthy.
I intend to. Thanks a lot.
Okay, so you're driving. You're a keen driver. You might sort of be aware of, obviously, changing road safety techniques and so on. And we are in the middle, of course, of Road Safety Week initiative. But what about the notion of sun glare? Well, over the last 10 years, there have actually been over 33,000 casualties due to road users being dazzled by the sun, being marked as a significant contributing factor. Now, this can also tie into the kind of prescription sunglasses you should be wearing. And to actually talk us through this, we're delighted to welcome back to the Midweek Drive A&E Doctor Extraordinaire, TV Personality Extraordinaire, and indeed ace lifelong car fanatic, which is something I wasn't aware of. It's Dr. Alex George. How are you, Alex?
Hey, Alex. It's good to chat to you. It's good to be back. Yeah, no, I'm a big car fan, big motor racing fan. But of course, we're not talking about motor racing today. It's safety very much on the road. I mean, I must say, I was shocked when I saw that research from Glasses Direct. 33,000 people in the last decade. I mean, that's astonishing, isn't it? And when you think about it, you know, a lot of those a lot of those potentially could have been prevented. You know, maybe if we had the you know, the right sunglasses, the right prevention, it could make all the difference. You know, we some of the other bits of the survey really surprised me in some ways, and maybe not. You know, what, around 1 in 5 drivers saying that they haven't had an eye test within the last 2 years. That's the recommended time. Every 2 years, you know, for people listening, you should get your eyes checked and tested by an optician. You know, 1 in 5 haven't done that. And, you know, when you're driving, you know, clearly having good vision is important. But, we're very much talking about sun dazzle here. And going into the winter months, it is a very dreary day in London. You know, it's hard to imagine sun dazzle, but actually it's one of the most dangerous times of the year because you have a very low hanging sun on sunrise and on sunset. So the risk of dazzle, especially with wet roads or icy roads, is even higher. So we know that in terms of car accidents, the most dangerous time is the hour after sunrise, and the hour before sunset. And undoubtedly, you know, the sun dazzle plays a role in that. So making sure you've got the right prescription glasses on, you've got sunglasses that are correct for those conditions, and that you know, you're prepared really and aware of those risks.
Well, I'm certainly well aware of the notion of sun dazzle. It is something which it has to be said that I've been surprised that we hear obviously on the roads about obviously wet conditions, windy conditions, etc. We never get those sort of signs which say beware the sun.
Yeah, no, it's not something that is discussed as much. And I think that's why probably that initial statistic shocked me so much. But when I imagine, so I'm from West Wales and Pembrokeshire way, and you know, from my university days, I drive from Plymouth around that kind of part of the peninsula of Bristol and then back through to West Wales, and often invariably it'd be at the end of the day, and I would often be affected by the sunlight, that kind of low hanging sun, and I can definitely remember some occasions of being like, wow, like, I, you know, this is really hard to actually see here, and you know, they're kind of trying to get your sunglasses on. So, you know, thinking ahead and planning and making sure you've got the right ones can, you know, can make the difference. I mean, I've been wearing Transitions driveways, a very, very clever science to it really. So they're lenses that actually change depending on the light conditions. So they go through from filtering a small amount of sunlight to a lot if it's really bright, put it simply, and as well as being polarized, so preventing dazzle. And that's quite handy because if you're driving like me back through the Newport tunnels back to West Wales, or indeed any tunnels in the country, then when it goes from that really bright light to a darker light in the tunnel, it'll actually do the transitions. You don't need to scramble and take them off. So yeah, using tech as your friend is a good bit of advice as well.
Very much so. And obviously, sun continues to rise in the east and sinks in the west, which is worth knowing from that perspective. So again, a reminder, of course, that if you are concerned about the store, if you wear glasses for driving, in any case, you also need to ensure that you have prescription-based sunglasses, not just off-the-shelf ones. That's not going to help at all.
No, well, and actually, you know, it's worth people thinking about as well, is that, you know, kind of sometimes you can get sunglasses that are not from retailers or manufacturers that do the approved kind of UV protection and so on. You can actually do more damage than good to your eyes. So if you're wearing glasses that don't have sun protection, UV protection and so on, actually what happens by wearing a dark sunglass, you're dilating your eyes, and actually the UV still going straight through and damaging your retina. So you know, and I didn't know that until well into my med school days. So I would really say to people, you know, just make sure when you're buying sunglasses, have a little look and make sure that they are actually UV protection, they're approved manufacturers, and that they, yes, as you said, that of course if you have a prescription, that they are prescription lenses and appropriate to you, but actually that they're giving you the protection. Otherwise you can actually damage your retina from doing that. So yeah, it's important to think about. You know, our eyes are incredible. They obviously allow us to, you know, to see, to experience life, but we've got to look after them as well. So those are a few little things to think about.
Very much so. I think we've certainly raised that point very effectively today. Where can people actually go to find out further information about the survey and indeed the importance of obviously ensuring that our eyes are looked after?
Yeah, so glassesdirect.co.uk have the full survey. There's actually a lot of information in there and data, which is interesting. So you can check out there, and also more guidance around getting tested and the kind of appropriate eyewear. But again, just a reminder for people, because it's so common, Every 2 years, you must get your eyes tested. And if you notice any difference in your vision, then go and see your optician. Just be safe, be careful. 33,000 accidents, obviously, that we're seeing, sun dazzle, sun glare. But, you know, I'm sure a significant number related to not having the right prescription as well. So just be careful on that front, so, you know, be safe.
As a petrol head, Alex, are you looking forward to the onset of driverless cars and driverless vehicles? Or is that a case of no, that'll take all the fun out of it?
Well, I mean, I think there is an inevitable change now towards electric, and I think, you know, sustainability, you know, and considering the environment, I think, you know, I live in a inner city area, and I definitely would welcome cleaner air living in London. I think anyone who lives in a town or city centre would agree with that. But yeah, I do enjoy the joy of driving. So I think we're probably a way off everyone going driverless, to be honest. So there's a few years left of enjoying cars, I hope. And indeed, thankfully, there are tracks that you can go and enjoy as well. So I'll be continuing to enjoy track days.
Dr. Alex George, A&E Doctor, TV personality. And as we've discovered today, lifelong car fanatic. Huge thanks. And I'm sure we'll speak again very soon. Take care.
Thank you, Alex. See you soon.
Sustainability, very important, particularly given the COP27 discussions and so on. What about businesses and sustainability? Well, it seems that business owners are choosing sustainability over cost when travelling. And to talk us through this, we're delighted to welcome the head of sustainability at Premier Inn. That's Rosanna Elias. How are you, Rosanna?
I'm very well. Nice to meet you, Alex.
Excellent. Likewise. Now, share with us this particular finding. It's good news, isn't it, actually, that people are realising they don't have to necessarily have a huge carbon footprint, and that actually, you know, there is a shift to business owners effectively thinking more sustainably.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the research that we've conducted shows us that business owners and decision makers, they're becoming increasingly environmentally conscious when it comes to business travel. And many of them are actually choosing to prioritise sustainability over the cost of travel, as you say.
So Premier Inn in particular, would you like to share with us how that company is also kind of taking the lead in this particular area?
Absolutely. I mean, this isn't something that we, it's not new to us. We've been working on sustainability for almost 10 years now. Fundamentally, we're looking at our carbon footprint and trying to reduce that. We've got a broad program, we call it Force for Good, that looks at our people, our communities and the environment. But reducing our carbon footprint is something that we're working really hard on. We're aiming to be net zero carbon by 2040 for all our operational, our scope 1 and 2 carbon emissions. So we've committed to only buying renewable electricity. We made that move back in 2017. We've got solar panels on over 20% of our hotels, and we're working really hard to reduce the amount of energy and fundamentally gas that we use in our hotels.
And I see you've already reduced carbon emissions by bringing forward your net zero carbon target from 2050 to 2040. You've also set an interim target in literally a little over 7.5 years, for about, well, nearly 8 years now, 2030, of 80% reduction from that point of view. And you also, unlike a lot of chains, have never used single-use toiletries in your bathrooms and so on. All that presumably has obviously paved the way to actually take a good lead in this particular challenge.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think we do like to think we're leading in the area. We're quite uniquely placed in that our business model means that we own and operate all of our sites. So if we do make a decision to make a change, we can implement that across all of our hotels. And obviously we're the biggest hotel brand in the UK. We've got over 840 hotels. So making a decision and a change like that to never use single-use toiletries in our sites, or we've just recently rolled out in-room recycling for all of our hotels, which means that our guests can now recycle when they stay with us. Making a decision and a change like that can have a huge impact, and that's something that we're very proud of.
82% of 25 to 34-year-old business owners are likely to choose a hotel with a good environmental credentials. That is a very significant finding, which presumably gives you a lot of satisfaction.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. It's something that we are really delighted to see. And it's something that we're hearing when we talk to our guests, our customers, and actually also our team members, the people that work for us from that generation and beyond. We're hearing that it's really important for them as well to work for a company that takes this seriously. But no, we're delighted to see that coming out in the research, that our business owners are caring so much about making sure they're spending money with environmentally conscious brands.
And Rosanna, could you just share with us a few words of wisdom on the Premier Inn Force for Good sustainability program, or FFG?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, fundamentally, it's all about enabling people to live and work well. So whether that's people in our own organisation, so looking after our own people, our communities, and making sure that we're a positive impact on those communities or the environment, enabling people in the across the planet to live and work well through making sure that we are responsible in terms of our environmental and ethical impact.
Best place to go to find out further information would be?
Would be premierin.com/business or our whitbread.com website.
And are you optimistic overall yourself? I mean, as somebody who obviously is at the heart of this whole process, do you feel as though actually we are making a difference? Or is it a case of, well, it's like a drop in the ocean?
No, I think, no, I am definitely optimistic. You have to be, and there's a lot of good progress going on. And we're seeing that even with things like trialing a new gasless site in Swindon, which is going to be a site that hopefully will have an absolute net zero, no carbon emissions at all. That's something that we weren't able to do a few years ago. I'm absolutely optimistic. And every day there's something new coming through.
Rosanna Elias, Head of Sustainability at Premier Inn. Keep on keeping on.
Thank you very much.